Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all ready to ride? Around the block now, everyday scene, dope fiends and the cops round. At any traffic stop, we could be shot down, and in the courts it's just us. Justice is not fair.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Injustice, a show that allows ask questions and seek advice. Each week, we feature guests who are making a difference in the Black community and or changing the criminal justice system. My name is Melinda Robinson, and I am your host and a member of the WPGR All-Female Radio Network. I am the founder of Black Mothers for Justice, Inc., a 501c3 nonprofit created to provide a safe space where mothers can talk openly about their children's convictions and hurt, pain, shame, and guilt without being judged. The mission is to bring Black mothers together from city to city and state to state and allow them to speak their truth and have their voices heard. On August 15th, 2020, I will be hosting a book release party for my latest book, Black Mother's Guide, How to Survive the Criminal Justice System. I wrote this book out of necessity because one in every three Black boys will go to prison in their lifetime, and 72% of households are run by Black mothers. It is a much-needed resource guide that provides information about arraignment, bail, public defenders, Miranda rights, etc., because knowledge is power. More details about the time and location of this event will be announced in the weeks to come. I am super excited and truly honored for the opportunity to interview the incomparable Reverend Dr. Willie F. Wilson, one of the greatest preachers of our time. For over 46 years, Reverend Wilson served as senior pastor of Union Temple Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. He has waged unrelenting wars against racism and discrimination, fighting for justice for the least fortunate, providing substance abuse counseling, housing services, AIDS referrals, youth intervention, and juvenile delinquent prevention services. In 1986, a local Chinese merchant disrespected a Black elderly customer, and it resulted in the largest and longest sustaining boycott in Anacostia's history. Reverend Wilson and area protesters shut down the merchant's business for 57 days, causing thousands of dollars in lost revenue. That same year, Reverend Wilson was recognized by USA Today as one of the 10 most influential people in America. As a political activist who has helped to shape the political landscape of the District of Columbia, Reverend Wilson was very instrumental in leading former D.C. Mayor Marion Barry in arguably the greatest comeback in the history of American politics. In 1992, President William Clinton presented Reverend Wilson and the Union Temple Baptist Church with the Presidential Service Award, the highest civilian award given by the White House for community service. In 1995, Reverend Wilson joined the historic Million Man March as a national organizer alongside the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. In 2000, Reverend Wilson served as the National Executive Director of the Millions More Movement. Under Reverend Wilson's leadership, Union Temple has been a mecca for Black pride in terms of civil rights and social justice movements, and over the years it has hosted many speakers and worked on many events that pushed for the liberation for people of colors with names like Rosa Parks, Dr. Dorothy Height, Reverend Jesse Jackson, and Minister Louis Farrakhan, amongst others. Reverend Wilson visited with President Nelson Mandela in South Africa and Winnie Mandela, and both spoke at Union Temple on numerous occasions. In 1992, in the nave of the church sanctuary, Reverend Wilson commissioned the 19x20 mural depicting a black Christ and his disciples, depicted as historic and significant African American. The mural is the only one of its kind in America and perhaps in the world. For more than 17 years, Reverend Wilson and Union Temple Baptist Church hosted UniFest, bringing thousands to the Anacostia community over a two-day period. With vendors and entertainment stages featuring gospel, jazz, R&B, hip-hop, go-go, and other popular music. The event featured musical stars that included Beyonce, Yolanda Adams, and the legendary Clark Sisters. Reverend Wilson, The Genius of Jesus Revealed, which was an expansion of his highly regarded mentor, Dr. Howard Thurman's classic volume, Jesus and the Disinherited. Reverend Wilson's most current book, The Birth of the Bible, uncovers the stolen African traditions that ultimately shaped the formation of the Bible and point to Africans as the authors of the original text. In November 2019, Reverend Wilson retired, and following his footsteps at Union Temple is his oldest daughter, Reverend Dr. Anika Wilson Brown, who is taking the church to the next level. Please help me welcome the esteemed Reverend Dr. Willie F. Wilson to the show. Reverend Wilson, are you there? We're going to take a brief intermission here. And be right back. Thank you.
You see me moving all the needed people out my life, and I'm trying to get these crazy thoughts out of my mind. Yeah, you gave me all the weapons, but it's still a fight. So help me maintain, help me maintain.
Yeah, I don't wanna live in stress or fear, 'cause it's getting crazier every day out here. All the love and peace you give to me, I hold so dear. So help me maintain, help me maintain. 'Cause as soon as I walk out the door, I need
sometimes I'm just not that smart, but I desperately just want to be where you are. And compared to a while ago, I've gotten far. So help me maintain, help me maintain.
Walk out the door.
different page. Help me maintain. Help me maintain all my joy, God. Help me maintain all my peace. Help me maintain my sanity. Help me maintain my smile, Jesus. Help me maintain my.
We are back. We are back. Sorry for the technical difficulties. I do apologize. I believe we are ready to go. Good evening, everyone, and welcome back. I do apologize for the inconvenience. I apologize for the inconvenience. There are some technical difficulties that's going on today, but I do believe that we are going to push through this. We rebuke the devil right now, and we're going to have this interview with the incomparable Reverend Willie F. Wilson. Reverend Dr. Willie F. Wilson to the show. Good evening, Reverend Wilson. Are you there?
I am here.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here tonight. How is the retired life, Rev?
It's my honor to be with you tonight. I thank God for the opportunity.
Oh, it's such a blessing to have you. So we're going to get right into it. Union Temple Baptist Church is a non-traditional church and deeply rooted in the community. What sets Union Temple aside from the other churches?
Well, I think one of the things that makes us a little bit different is that we live by the religion of Jesus instead of the religion about Jesus. There's a distinct difference between Christianity as it has been practice as opposed to the actual teachings of Jesus. When you look at what Jesus was about when he stood up to speak for the very first time in the temple at Jerusalem in Luke, the fourth chapter, he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring some good news to the poor, to set at liberty those who are captive," and not just physically captive, but those whose minds have been incarcerated, and to give sight to the blind, not just physically blind, but those who have not seen what they need to see. So I think in living out, I guess to give you an example of what I'm talking about, my mentor, who was the same mentor for Martin Luther King Jr., one of my mentors, the late, great Dr. Howard Thurman, who wrote over 20 books. He went to India to a world religious conference, and he didn't want to go. The YMCA was sending him. This was in 1935. He didn't want to go, but he decided to go. He and his wife and another pastor and his wife, they get over there and go by ship. when they finally get there, all these religions are there. It's a world religious conference. Muslims are there. Buddhists are there. Hindus are there. Christians are there. As soon as he gets off the boat, being a black man, they ask him, how in the world can you come over here saying that you are a Christian when we know that one of the ships that brought your ancestors to America in slavery from West Africa was a ship that was named Jesus? And how can you come over here saying that you are a Christian when we were reading in your newspapers just the other day, white Christians were having a church service. They heard that a lynching was going on. They stopped the service, went out and lynched a black man, came back in and continued having service. And how can you come over here saying you are a Christian when we see all the things that they have done to you? And the man who wrote the song Amazing Grace was a big slave owner in America. His answer was, I do not come over here as a Christian. I come as a follower of Jesus, and that is a distinct difference. So we have spent all the years that we've ministered in this city of Washington, D.C., trying to minister to the downtrodden, the oppressed, to the poor, to the blind, to all those who cannot see what they need to see and make a difference in their lives.
Wow. Wow, boy. Thank you so much for sharing that. That is something that I hope the listeners can take away from, because so many of us have been misled. I'm so thankful to be a part of Union Temple. The foundation of Union Temple is rooted in African culture, Rev. Why was that so important to you?
It was so important to me because, as you know, I think with the Black Lives Matter movement that's going on right now, we see all of a sudden becoming aware of a hidden history, the fact that we have been lied to, lied on, and lied about history. People have not known until just a week or so ago that the great first president, George Washington, yanked the teeth out of a slave because he didn't have any teeth, and put that slave's teeth in his mouth. We didn't know, many of us still don't know, that Abraham Lincoln said the two races will never be able to live together. He brought a group of black leaders and preachers together at the White House in 1862. He says, you all need to separate from us because we'll never be able to live in peace. And you all are the reason that we're having this war. So I have asked Congress to give me $600,000 to relocate you all to what is now Panama. It was called Chiriquee then, so you can go live there because you are not here. I never have and never will see you as who are equal to white people in this country. So that's history. So because our history has been stolen, they stole so much from us in terms of our culture, our religion, everything, that needs to be a place. We don't get it in the schools. We don't get it anywhere else. So where else can we get it but the church? So we have tried to fuse the African culture in terms of the African way of doing, acting, thinking, and feeling in everything that we do, because indeed we are African people, and we should not be trying to imitate somebody else, but rather to be ourselves.
Yes, yes. Wow. So, Rev, have you always been socially conscious about the plight of black people?
I have always been socially conscious about the plight of black people. My mother used to tell me, she didn't know where I got it from, but I know. She said that at age 5, I would say things that would bewilder her about relations in America, in this country. She said she didn't know where I got it from, but I know where I got it from. You know, there's a new field, relatively so, in psychology called epigenetics. And what epigenetics says is that when you go through severe trauma, that knowledge and what you experience has not been lost. It endures, it lasts, and it's passed on to future generations. Both of my grandfathers, my great-great-grandfather, was hung by his thumbs until death. because he dared to fight for his people and to stand up for that which was right in terms of fairness and equality and justice in his country. The other, my great grandfather had his leg amputated. He had a wooden peg leg because he would run away, go out into the woods, sneak back on the plantation at night, and cook some food in the woods, bring it back, and feed it to his fellow slaves because they were being fed slop. And he just didn't want his people to eat like that. So they finally caught him. They cut off his leg. He had a wooden peg leg. My father, who was able to see him before he passed, my father said he asked him one day in that North Carolina dialect, I'm going to see if you can understand what he asked him. He said, "Who you reckon able me to do that, my son?" Do you know what he said? "Who you reckon able me to do that, my son?"
Wow.
You think?
What?
He
I can't
said,
think
who
of that.
You,
what
who, are you, who you Reagan? They would say Reagan for think. He said, "Who you Reagan able me to do that, my son? Who do you think enable me to do that, my son?" And my father answered, "God." And he said, "That's what I thought."
Wow.
So I got it uniquely from my ancestors, and it was imbibed in my subconscious mind. And even in my early years of 5 years or so of age, I knew that there was something. And even sitting in church, both of my grandfathers were preachers, I can remember sitting there in church and saying to myself, "There is more, and I'm going to find it." And that propelled me through the years to seek and to search. You know, there's a scripture that says, if you seek, you'll find. And if you knock, the door will be open, and if you ask, it shall be given. That's divine law. Not maybe you will find. Not maybe if you ask, it will be given. Not maybe if you knock, the door will be open. But every time you seriously and earnestly knock for an answer, for an understanding, the Creator, Almighty God, will reveal it to you. And much of what I know today was through my knocking and asking and seeking.
Wow. Wow. Whew, that is a lot. That is so amazing, Rev. You preaching, Reverend Wilson. Where does your passion to fight for the disenfranchised come from?
Well, as I said earlier, it comes from my ancestors who were fighters. I tell you, in Virginia, my family was the only family, when they integrated the schools in Virginia, when after the 1954 decision that segregation was outlawed and that they had to integrate the schools with all deliberate speed, Virginia tried to get around integrating the schools. So they came up with this paper that you had to sign called the Pupil Placement Plan. If you signed it, they could still assign you to a segregated school. So my parents were the only two parents in the entire state of Virginia who did not sign that paper. So what did they do? They put us out of school. We were out of school for over a year. My mother homeschooled us at home. My father was fired from his job. The only way we made it was he had a pickup truck, and he hustled, and he sold food, vegetables, and fish from the truck. And we would go out and sell fish, go down to the docks in Virginia, down in Tidewater, you know where all that water is. You could go down to the shore at the docks and buy 100 pounds of fish for $9, and we'd buy about 1,000 pounds of fish, put it on that truck and ice it down and go out and sell it. And on a good day, we would make a couple of $100s. And that's how we made it. But it was the struggle of my parents. My mother homeschooled us at home for that entire year. When we finally went to court, I'll never forget it, at Norfolk Circuit Court, the judge said, "The government must provide an education for every student." It didn't take 3 minutes, and we were back in school. So that drive from my parents, even though I didn't understand it at the time, I cried because me and my sister were the only ones in the whole area not going to school. but we fought it out. My father told me, sometimes you have to stand if you have to stand alone, if you know that you're right. And so we stood, and at the end, with my mother homeschooling me, we went back to school, and we were ahead of the students who had been going to school every day.
Wow. So, Red, we are living in some uncertain times due to the pandemic. In your lifetime, have you seen anything remotely close to what we are experiencing today?
Yes, I have. And the reason I have is because I've studied history, and I know that history repeats itself. You know, there's a saying that says, if you don't learn the lessons of history, you stand and repeat it. So then, you must be able to understand the past so that you can deal with the present, and then you will be able to understand what's going on in the future. In 1932, the exact same thing happened. I want you to get this. We had a crazy president then, Herbert Hoover. We got a crazy president now, Donald Trump. They did the exact same thing. There was a Great Depression when Hoover was president. And so the stock market crashed, and about 14.5 million people were unemployed. Today it's 19 million. There was a rise in racism because even the low-pay, entry-level jobs that only blacks would do because whites were unemployed, it got so vicious that whites were even killing blacks to take their jobs. And so then you had Hoover, who had no compassion for the people. They urged him to say something, to give the people hope, just like others have done with President Trump, who's refused to do. So our ancestors went through the exact same thing. In addition to the Great Depression, there was a drought. So 90% of our people who were living on farms, sharecropping, they lost their sharecropping situations, and so we were hungry. When you talk about food lines, you know, at least we're getting some groceries now. Then our ancestors were lucky to get a piece of bread. They stood in line to just get a piece of bread. I guess that's when they started with passing out a little cheese and things like that to our ancestors. So, indeed, I have seen it in my spirit because I know history, but I also know how we made it and how we overcame. And that's why I think that's one of the things that will keep us going today. If we understand that, you know, we've been through this before, this ain't the first time.
Wow. Well, some people say that God is doing this. Is God angry? That is the reason why he's allowed this pandemic to happen, or was this man-made and God is just expanding and he has the power to make it worldwide? Do you think it's any truth to them saying that it was a man-made pandemic, you know, COVID-19?
Well, that is possible. You know, as you know, there are studies ongoing right now. There are already 8 billion people on this planet. The projection is in a few years it'll be 9 billion people. There will not be enough water for everybody. There will not be enough food for everybody. So as has been the case throughout history, there's always been an effort to kill off the poor whites and most especially black people so that only those who have means will be able to live. Well, we're moving in that same direction all over again. I think the key word that you said was allow. God allows, but he didn't make it happen. You know, God gives us free will, and he gives us choice. And there are so many wicked people on the earth who by their choices, who because they're so greedy, because they want to have everything for themselves, because they don't think others are valuable enough. And when I say that, I don't mean just black people, but poor whites. If you know history, you know that in the 1920s and 30s, they not only tried to kill black people, but all the poor whites in America, because they saw them as not being pure blue-blood whites. And not only them, but Jews, Italians, and Irish. They tried to kill all those groups of people, and only people that they wanted to live were what they call the pure white Aryan race, which does not exist, by the way, because everybody came from the first African woman over 200,000 years ago. So that there is no such thing as a pure white race, because the white came out of that first African woman. But the whole matter of this is what I'm getting at is that God gives us free will, and he gives us choice. He says, "Behold, I stand at the door and I knock." He didn't say like the big bad wolf, "Behold, I stand at the door and I woof and I huff and I puff and I blow your door down." No, he said, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. And if you open up, I'll come in and I'll sup with you and I'll be your God and you will be my people." But we have so many wicked, recalcitrant folk who are consumed by greed and racism that they don't care about the masses of impoverished people. And so then God gives us that free will, and through that we make choices. Everybody has choices to make in life, and it is up to us what choices we make. And unfortunately, there are many who have determined, you know, Planned Parenthood was started by Margaret Sanger, and her whole effort was to wipe out poor people and black people. She started a Negro project in Harlem, New York, in the 1920s and 30s. And the whole idea was to vaccinate black women so that they would not have any children, so that they could eliminate black people who were, they felt, taking advantage of and leaning on society and not contributing anything to society. It's quite interesting that on the board of Planned Parenthood was Bill Gates' father. Now, here we have Bill Gates at the forefront of spending all these hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a vaccine. And what have they said? They want to test it out on black people first. And I say, test it out on yourself first. They want to test it out on African people and on black people first to see what it does to us, when they have been saying all along it would take up to 10 years to create a vaccine. Now they're talking about by the end of this year or the beginning of next year, and we're going to start with the black people because they're the most susceptible, and try it out on them. But I answer that by saying, I guess I went around a long way to say it, but it's because of the choices of men that all of the things that are afflicting us are occurring right now. And it's not beyond those men to devise means to wipe out and destroy. It kind of falls on deaf ears for me to say the reason that the most of the people that are dying from this virus are black people, because of where they live and because of the health deficiencies that we have. That might be part of it, but I don't think that's all of it. And so it's about choice. I think God allows it, but he doesn't create it.
Yes. Listeners, please press 1 if you want to get in on this conversation and speak to the one and only Reverend Willie Wilson. So, Rev, families have been shattered during the pandemic. Loved ones have been dying suddenly and alone. They've been waiting weeks to have their proper burials. Can you offer some words of encouragement to the people that have been affected personally by COVID-19?
Yes, I can. And what I would say first and foremost, we need to go back. And when I say go back, you know, like I said, we went through this in 1930s. We went through as bad a situation as this, when our people were dying all kinds of ways, starving to death, you know. And the one thing that sustained us, one, first of all, is to have faith in God, to believe that God will bring us out. I mean, you ask yourself the question, if there are two children, one born and raised in a privileged environment, and another one raised in an environment where he has to struggle and things don't come easy. Well, when a crisis comes, who do you think will make it? The one who had it easy, or the one that had to struggle and because of that learn how, as the elders used to say, make do? When we went through this before, any time a people is going through a struggle for survival like we are, there must be a sense of historical continuity. By that I mean, someone needs to remind you that eons and eons ago, we went through this before, and what did we do? One, we trusted in God. Number two, we looked out for each other. We cared about each other. We shared what we had with each other. And if we put those two things together, trust in God, and keep that faith no matter what's going on, no matter how dark it gets. There's that song, no matter what's going on, you got to hold on. And then not only must you have faith, but you must support each other. You must look out for each other, which basically boils down, if I got some, you got some. And as long as it's like that, we'll make it out of this. We'll come out better than before, because history says we can do it. Our ancestors say we can do it, because they went through similar things and even worse, and they came out. And if we have that kind of mentality, we'll come out too.
Absolutely, absolutely. George Floyd's death by the Minnesota police sparked protests from all over the world. Red, were you surprised by the worldwide response?
I wasn't surprised, because in this age of social media, if you go back to the civil rights struggle, what made things change in the civil rights struggle was television. When all over the world, pictures were shown of black people peacefully demonstrating and police sicking dogs on them and turning water hoses from the fire hydrants on them and beating them with billy clubs and in some instances even shooting them. When those pictures went out all over the world, America, which had tried to tell the world how fair it was, and all up into the affairs of other countries, telling them you got to be humane, you got to be just. And when people all over the world saw that, America had to change. So it is now, it's even more so today with social media. Something can happen in Washington, D.C., and they know about it in Africa in a minute. Something can happen in America, and they know about it in Germany in 30 seconds because of the World Wide Web. And so the public consensus all over the world to see a man murdered before their eyes with a knee on his neck for 8.5, almost 9 minutes, while the policeman puts his hand in his pocket and looks around like ain't nothing going on. When that kind of picture went out all over the world, people rose up. Anybody that had any ounce of humanity had to be have some compassion and had to be moved by seeing that happen in live, living color on the social media, on the internet, on television, all over the world. So I'm not surprised because of the quick, instant exposure of cameras. People had heard about things like this, but thank God for the cell phone, because people videoed it and put it out there, and people all over the world saw what was going on. And as you know, there are thousands of cases like that. That's just one of many. And as you notice on social media every day now, here's another one where police have violated the rights of a young black man. There's one in Colorado just the other day, a young black man who had respiratory disease, and that's why he had a mask on. They stopped him, didn't weigh but 140 pounds. Three policemen, they put a knee on him and killed him. Same thing. So there are thousands of cases like that. But when it gets shown and exposed, if a person has an ounce of humanity, they have to react.
Yes, yes.
Do you think George Floyd's death is the reason why racism is at an all-time high in this country?
That's one reason. One reason is because anytime black people have dared to stand up at any time, you know the history, we have been lynched, we have been jailed, we have been murdered throughout history. So it's not new. We still have a lot of racists in this country who don't like the fact. You know, you hear them say, when you say Black Lives Matter, they say all lives matter, which, I mean, it's another racist response to a situation because black lives ain't never mattered in this country. All lives ain't never mattered in this country. Black lives have never mattered in this country. And so and the other thing is, and this is why we got to be very careful about the vaccines and everything that is being done to try to destroy people of color, the fact that in just a few years, unless something is done, the majority population in America will be black and brown people. Now, those who are racist don't like that idea. And then they see on television almost every commercial you see, it's an interracial couple. It's either a black man and a white woman or a white man and a black woman. And for those who think they have a pure white race and who fear losing their control and their power with the statistic that, you see, among women, they're only, in order for a race to reproduce itself, every woman has to have 2.1 babies. None of the European nations, England, Germany, United States, Italy, France, are the women having 2.1 babies. They're having anywhere from 1 to 1.1 or 1.2. The only people who are having 2.1 babies or more are brown people and black people. Mm-hmm. So they are reproducing their population. But if you have 30,000 people and the women don't have 2.1 babies, the next generation, their population is going to decrease. And if it keeps on happening that way, they won't exist. And so that's one of the great fears that's propelling racists, the fear that they will be overcome and they will be dominated by brown people and black people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, Rev, we're going to switch gears here. Innocent children across the nation have been killed by gun violence over the past few weeks. And as you know, the 11-year-old little boy in D.C., an 8-year-old
yes.
little girl in Atlanta, a 20-month-old baby, a 3-year-old in Chicago. What do you attribute this kind of recklessness to and this senseless violence that we are seeing today?
You know, what America's done, I saw a sign of a young black boy who was participating in the demonstrations a few weeks ago. He had a sign that said, "You lock my daddy up, and then you say, we don't have no fathers." And when you think about that, all the things that have been done over the last 40 years to destroy the black community, they created crack cocaine, and then flooded our communities with it, and then locked up our men, and for the most part, some of our women too, but mostly our men, so that now it's almost 2 million people incarcerated in America, more than any country in the world. So they've destroyed our communities with drugs, but with the prison industrial complex, and so we have young people, when we talk about the guns, who don't feel loved. They don't have the families that they need. And you know when boys get to be a certain age, they will buck a female because a female has much more of a soft sensitivity to a son than a man. And so when the men are gone, here are these young boys. I remember a situation I've often talked about. You may have heard me talk about it. Some years ago, a young black man, 14 years old, up at East Capitol Street, he saw a woman stop at the red light. He said, "I feel like capping somebody." Pulled out his gun and shot the woman in the head and killed her. Washington Post did a 3-page story on that, and his street name was Little Man. They went to his neighborhood, asked the neighbors, what kind of person was little man? Oh, he was kind. He helped the elders. He went to the grocery store for them, and he did this and did that. And then they talked to his girlfriend, had a girlfriend. He was 14 years old. Went to talk to his girlfriend and said, what can you tell us about little man that we don't know? She said, well, we were in the kitchen one day, and he was in the kitchen. My grandmama was in the kitchen. She leaned over his shoulder and wrapped her arms around his neck and said, little man, I love you. And tears started streaming down his face. And she said, my grandmother asked little man, what you crying for? He said, I'm 14 years old, and I ain't never had nobody to tell me that they love me. And so we got, you know, you see the gentrification, you see the unemployment, you see our people dying with the virus, and young men are feeling no hope. So when they feel that don't nobody love them, they don't love nobody. And it don't make no difference. They randomly will go out here in the middle of broad daylight and shoot with no regard for who may be in the way, because they have no hope. And because they have no hope, and because they don't feel love, they feel that there's nothing to live for anyway. So what? You know, some few years ago, we had so many of our youngsters planning their funerals at 14, 15 years of age, because they didn't feel any value in living. They said, well, shoot, let me go on and plan my funeral because I ain't going to live long anyway, and I don't care. So I'm going to go out here and kill or be killed. And that's what we have going on right here, right now. And until we can recover some sense of community, you know, with all the, you know, Trump and pardoning his friend, what he needs to do is pardon many of the hundreds of thousands of young black men who are in jail on nonviolent crimes, so that they can be fathers to their children and support their families, the families that they destroyed. I went to court for Rafer Edmonds' hearing a few months ago, and I testified in his behalf. And I testified from the standpoint that I told the judge, I said, United States government created crack cocaine in a laboratory at UCLA in California, and then brought it and spread it all over America. And I said, so really, Rafer is a victim just like everyone else, because the government. So until you lock the government up for spreading this crack cocaine all over America and then creating sentences to lock up our men and give them 15 and 20 and 30 years for something that the United States government created, that you have no right to lock up a man for life, a young man as it was when he got locked up, for doing something that the government had programmed and orchestrated.
Wow. So in the early 90s, when D.C. was labeled the murder capital of the world, Union Temple Baptist Church, under your leadership, partnered with the D.C. Police Department, I believe, and you guys provided different locations where people could turn in their guns with no questions asked, taking hundreds of guns off the street. Were those efforts successful then?
Well, I would say not, because if I don't know if you saw it, a lot of the people turned in guns that were no good, old guns that they had in the house that wasn't no good. All they knew, I'm going to get $100 for turning this gun in. But it wasn't a lot of the young men who were doing the shootings bringing their guns in, you know. Back in, I think it was around 1992, we shut down the 14th Street Bridge. I had 200 men locked up in the church. Didn't let anybody leave because I didn't want anybody to go out and let anybody know what we were doing or planning to do. They didn't know, but I just didn't want that for security reasons. About 4 o'clock in the morning, I loaded up the men, had buses, and went out across the 14th Street Bridge and stopped. The bus driver said, why are you stopping here? Ain't nothing here. I said, I know. This is where we're getting off. My plan was if we could stop the flow of cars into the community, into the city, the government could stop the flow of guns into the city.
Mm-hmm.
So we laid down in the street, blocked the traffic out coming into D.C. so that when the sun came up, traffic was blocked up for 26 miles. The state troopers mm-hmm. came to try to get us up. We wouldn't move. Then the park police came and tried to get us up, and we didn't move. Then finally Chief Ike Fullwood came. He was the chief of police at that time. He said, Rev, you prove your point. Now get up, because they're going to start beating heads, because they had put their helmets on. They started hitting their billy clubs in their hands. I gave the brothers an affirmation. God is in me, with me, through me, and for me. And where God is, there can be no imperfection. And every time they tried to walk up to us with those billy clubs, they had to stop about 5 feet away, and then they would back up. They did that several times, and then I guess they didn't know what was happening, why it is that they couldn't proceed. And then finally we just got on up, and they made the arrest, and they locked us up momentarily, and we got out. But what I'm saying is, in the same way, now you may have a few who break into some gun shops out in Virginia and Maryland, but for the most part, somebody, and I say the government, is flooding these guns into our community. I have documentation to back that up, and I know that the government has done all kinds of things to disrupt our community, and particularly at times when things get really bad for us, so that we won't rise up against them. They make it possible for us to rise up against each other.
Each other. Mm-hmm. Yep, against each other. So, Rand, what do you think is the solution to ending gun violence?
Well, I think, number one, the government got to stop flooding guns in our community. And the second thing is, if we can get more of our men organized to go into our communities and relate to our young brothers. I mean, these are our sons and daughters, you know. Many of our adults are afraid of our youth. We're scared of them. We think because society has created that image that they are the worst things on earth. And, of course, they're not, you know. And if they can be shown and that they're, there are many among us who have done a lot of great work, like Tyrone Parker and the Alliance of Concerned Men and others who have gone into the community. We have done it at Union Temple and building relationships with young men. You know, those two factors, I think, are the two main things that will stop this. And then rebuilding our community, getting our fathers back to be fathers to these young men and give them some direction and some guidance. And that's all they need.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's definitely what we need. So, Rev, you've been retired for over 6 months now. Are you enjoying the retirement life?
Well, actually, you know I'm not retired.
I know.
That's just a word. You know, I got to keep working as long as I can work. I'm doing this, doing lectures on Facebook right now. I'm getting ready to do a podcast, and I got a lot of things in mind. I got some more writing to do. I got a couple more books in my head that I need to get down on paper like you. And so I'm not finished. I'm not finished. Oh, true soldiers don't retire. You know, they just shift. And so I'm shifting to another level of work. I'm not at the church. I'm so proud that my daughter's doing a great job. And it's time, you know, when you reach a certain age, it's time. The scriptures say that the old and wise men shall give counsel. And that's my primary job now. That's why I'm teaching and doing these lectures on Facebook, because it's my time to counsel and teach. And it's time for others to step up, the younger generation to step up and be leaders. And it's our job as older leaders to prepare them, to give them the foundation that they need so that they can go on and continue the legacy of strong leadership to work and fight for the freedom and the liberation of our people.
Yes, yes. So do you ever miss being in the pulpit, Fred?
Oh, I'll always miss that, you know. I miss that very, very, very much. You know, when you do something for 46 years like I did, it's just a part of you, you know. On Saturday nights now, I find myself thinking about preparing, getting ready, you know, and then I say, oh, no, I ain't got to do that no more, you know, but that's the way it goes. But I'll never not want to do that, and I think that what I'm doing on Facebook and some of the other speaking engagements that I'm doing kind of like takes up that slack, but it's nothing like in the congregation seeing all the beautiful people like you who mean so much to me, who have, and seeing their faces and all of that. You always miss that, you know, but you can't do that forever. And I think I surely did it at the right time. I know I was in a church meeting about a year ago, and Pastor Anika and I were doing the meeting together. I was going to do the first half. She was going to do the second half. Now, I had a great plan, but I'm old school. I'm passing out my little outline and syllabus with all the information, and I finished the first half, and then she pulls the screen down and turns on the computer and puts this high technical presentation with charts and graphs in color on the screen. And when she finished, I said to the official, I said, yep, it's time for me to retire now. I can see it, you know, but it's time for her to go on and do her thing. I mean, I couldn't do what she did that day if my life depended on it. You know, I could do a good outline, but, you know, I couldn't do all that stuff that she did with all those graphs and charts and designs and graphics and what have you, you know. But
that's
that just told me it's my time, you know.
A sign of the times, huh? So, Reverend
that's
Wilson,
right.
Do you have any upcoming events or departing words you would like to leave with the listeners tonight?
Well, I would just say to all the listeners, just be encouraged, and to you as well, because you're doing great, 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 great work. I'm so proud
Thank
of you.
You
and the work that you're doing, the books that you've published,
you,
and your broadcast here. And I just want to say to all of the listeners, keep the faith. If you don't, I think everybody, we are an innately spiritual people. And when things get tough, we know where our help comes from. And we need to, more than ever, call on that power that is greater than we are, that will bring us out of these difficult times. And at the same time, to see each and every one as your brother and your sister, and let's support each other, let's care about each other. When, you know, there was a time in our community, if your mama needed a couple of eggs, she could go next door and borrow. My mama said, can you send a couple of eggs till we get some? You know, that kind of spirit is the kind of spirit that we need to rekindle in our community. And we'll make it through this, and we'll come out better than we ever did before, trusting God and supporting each other.
Wow. Thank you so much, Reverend Wilson. It has been an honor having you on the show. Please tell Reverend Mary hello for me. You guys take care, and thank you so much for the ministry that you have poured into us for so many years. We love you, Rev, and you take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My pleasure to be with you. Have a good evening.
Okay. Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Jesus. Union Temple Baptist Church is the epitome of the black church. I thank God for the ministry and the leadership that Reverend Wilson has given us. And I pray that if you don't have a church home, come on over to the temple, and you will definitely be as blessed as we have been for so many years. Thank you and good night.
Y'all ready to ride?